When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today's Real Vision Daily Briefing is brought to you by Chintai, your partner in asset tokenization. Licensed and regulated by Singapore's Monetary Authority and powered by the innovative CHEX token, Chintai offers a compliant, one-stop solution for bringing real-world assets on-chain. Chintai enables the tokenization of virtually any asset, from carbon credits to corporate debt, private funds, and real estate, enhancing liquidity and optimizing efficiency for all.
The technology becomes largely invisible and seamless to the end user. I can take a selective store of value within a wider portfolio in a fairly liquid form, very efficiently, to anything, whether it's some high-value whiskey, whether it's a particular supercar that's a one of three limited edition, therefore in this fungible trading of them in a liquid form, is the true end game here for tokenization.
With billions of dollars in client deals facilitated, explore how you can take advantage of tokenization by visiting realvision.com/chintai. Did we just get fresh signs of a soft landing? Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Maggie Lake. With me today is Colin Roche, founder and CIO of Discipline Funds. Hi there, Colin. Great to have you on the show.
Hey, Maggie. It's great to talk with you.
Yeah, and happy Friday. We made it. And it's been one heck of a week. We're going to dive into a little bit of what's been happening and some of the news today, the jobs report. But you've been a guest on Real Vision before, but I think this is your first time on the Daily Briefing. So why don't we kick off with an overview? Just give us a sense of your approach. And I'm guessing that you called it Discipline Fund for a reason.
Yeah. So I'm a financial advisor by background. And so I work with a lot of retirees, a lot of people who are very time conscientious. And so a lot of my investment focus is based on helping people navigate time. And so I focus a lot on the behavioral hurdles of, you know, the troubles of navigating time, because that's ultimately, you know, the thing that all of us are fighting. And investing is really hard because we don't necessarily understand the time horizons over which we're going to have certain amounts of assets in our portfolios. And so a lot of our investment approach is very time focused, helping people build financial plans and then applying an investment strategy that instills a certain amount of discipline over very specific time horizons to help them plan for the future, plan for retirement and all of, you know, life's trials and tribulations.
That's amazing. And we talk about time frame a lot here because you're right. It's the one piece that sometimes people either forget about or they struggle with, especially when they're thinking about risk management. But also we had a conversation yesterday, you know, you can have a narrative view of a long-term trend, but how do you make sure that you can sort of survive to see it through or kind of navigate some of the volatility that comes in between, yeah, kind of layered against that narrative? So fantastic for us to have you here today. When you're talking about sort of the makeup of funds or you're advising people, just want to get your thoughts on bonds, because there's been a lot happening on the bond front. A lot of people kind of wondering if they are a diversifier or a good hedge on inflation. Are you changing the way you think about asset makeup or fund makeup given some of what we've been seeing on the macroeconomic front?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think that one of the big lessons from especially the last few years is that bonds are not a good inflation hedge. And I think that that's a mistake a lot of people sometimes think of when they buy bonds, is that, for instance, a lot of people, I think, have tried to replace things like tips in their portfolio or, you know, utilizing bonds in a way that tries to sort of jerry-rig them into being an inflation hedge. And that just doesn't work, because I mean, my view basically is that bonds are principal stabilizers. When you buy the right types of bonds over the right time horizons, you know, when you buy a one-year treasury bill, you're buying something that has basically absolute principal certainty over a one-year time horizon. It has no credit risk. You know that it's a AAA rated instrument. You know exactly what the income is from that instrument. So you know, that's a very specific temporal based instrument. Whereas, you know, when you buy something like a 30-year treasury bond, you're buying something that has a huge amount of uncertainty over a 30-year period. And so, you know, but the really important thing is that I think that most importantly with bonds is they're implicitly principal stabilizers in a portfolio, whereas other assets are best utilized as inflation hedges. The stock market's a great inflation hedge. Something like Bitcoin can be an inflation hedge. Your home, I mean, God, a house with a mortgage has been the absolute best inflation hedge over the course of the last few years. So real assets, you know, things outside of the bond market are, I think, more appropriately thought of as growth instruments or inflation hedges. And the bond market, when properly utilized, is very specifically a principal stabilizer.
Great, great differentiation. And you're right, we have to think of it holistically, right? Because sometimes people just look at their 401 or their IRA, they got to think about their house or real estate or other real assets as well. And sometimes it sounds absurd, but sometimes we forget about that when we're trying to think about
and it's
because we live
important.
In it, right?
When I go through a financial plan with somebody, for instance, whether they're a homeowner or a renter is a really crucial distinction, because if you own a home, you can make a really strong argument that you don't need a lot of other real assets in your portfolio. Because what is a home at the end of the day? It's a big block of commodities that sits on a big piece of land. So it's all real assets. And it's very explicitly an inflation hedge because it's comprised of inflation hedged materials or materials that will be highly correlated to the you know, price increases over time. So versus, you know, a renter, this is, again, you see this with a lot of the stickiness in inflation and these, you know, the big rent increases in the last few years. A renter has a completely different risk profile when it comes to being inflation hedged, because they're much more exposed in terms of not having that real asset hedge that a homeowner has.
Hey, everyone, we're going to take a quick break right now to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. Today's Real Vision Daily Briefing is brought to you by Chintai, your partner in asset tokenization. Licensed and regulated by Singapore's Monetary Authority and powered by the innovative CHEX token, Chintai offers a compliant, one-stop solution for bringing real-world assets on-chain. Chintai enables the tokenization of virtually any asset, from carbon credits to corporate debt, private funds, and real estate, enhancing liquidity and optimizing efficiency for all.
The technology becomes largely invisible and seamless to the end user. I can take a selective store of value within a wider portfolio in a fairly liquid form, very efficiently, to anything, whether it's some high-value whiskey, whether it's a particular supercar that's a one of three limited edition, therefore, and this fungible trading of them in a liquid form is the true end game here for tokenization.
With billions of dollars in client deals facilitated, explore how you can take advantage of tokenization by visiting realvision.com/chintai. You've heard the headlines. Inflation is unchecked. The dollar is collapsing. The government is printing too much money. The fear is real, but there is a solution: gold. The government can't print more gold. Gold isn't collapsing, and gold's value increases during inflationary times. Noble Gold Investments is here to help you protect your wealth. Noble Gold Investments is the gold IRA company that Americans trust. The founders of Noble Gold have more than 20 years of combined experience in buying gold and silver. They've secured more than $1 billion in precious metals for their clients. Whether you're a seasoned investor or new to the game, Noble Gold Investments simplifies and secures your gold investment journey. Choose between a tax-advantaged gold IRA or have physical gold delivered to your door. Noble Gold Investments ensures a seamless and easy transaction. Invest in something you can hold. Go to noblegoldinvestments.com/vision to get started. Don't wait. That's noblegoldinvestments.com/vision.
Boy, I tell you, we get a lot of questions about rent or own. We're going to have you roll up for the next workshop we do, because it is a big issue, and it's one that's really a generational issue, right? We get that a lot with some of the younger people or people who are sort of just getting into family creation, formation timeline, as opposed to those who are thinking about retiring and maybe have a different view of what to do with that property. All right, so let's dive in. So we had We saw a lot of swings in the job report today. Rather in the markets this week, we had a job report out today. Seemed like it was positively received by the market. What did you make of that?
Yeah, it was, I generally hate the term Goldilocks, but in large part because I think in the original text, Goldilocks gets eaten by the bears at the end. So not right. always properly used, but I mean, in terms of like the way that this report came out, yeah, it looked not too hot, not too cold. I mean, it was a small miss. So it was 175 versus, you know, what was the market expected, 240 or something like that. So a small miss, but not a miss that is indicative of like a recession or, you know, I think the point where people would start to argue the Fed made a policy mistake would be the point where like the unemployment rate starts to go up. So if we started to see either huge revisions or big job losses and a sharp increase in the unemployment rate, that's the point where people would say, you know, the hard landing is here now. The Fed made a policy mistake by moving rates too far, too fast, and then keeping them too high for too long. And so it'll be interesting. That narrative is not necessarily dead, or that risk is not necessarily dead going forward into the end of the year. And the election makes all of this, you know, even more interesting with the timing of what the Fed is going to do. So,
think a recession risk is still You think a recession risk is still a possibility? Because I feel like what the Treasury bond market was telling us earlier this week, last week, was that, hang on a second, this economy's red hot. The Fed has been kind of teasing the idea of easing. They're wrong. Rates are higher for longer. Inflation's a problem.
Yeah. Well,
are they wrong?
I think the really interesting thing about the next 6 to 9 months is that the Fed is in a weird spot with the election in particular, because the election, I think, in my theory at least, I mean, some people are still saying, like I saw that Jan Hatzius from Goldman was still saying that July is, you know, a rate cut possibility. I don't see it, just because I don't think core inflation is going to come down enough before July for the Fed to say, okay, we feel totally comfortable cutting rates now and sending that signal. And that's really interesting, because if we get past July, the next meeting is September. And then you're getting into a situation where you're really close to the election.
Yeah.
The meeting after that is the day after the election, I believe. And then there's a December meeting. And so if we don't get a cut in July, I highly doubt we're going to get a cut in September, just because I don't think the Fed, unless something really screwy is going on with the labor market, let's say then we're getting like negative prints or something, maybe the Fed cuts in September. But I think if you get anything that even is marginally positive, indicative of still kind of remotely sticky inflation, I don't think they're going to implement a rate cut a few weeks before the election. I mean, imagine the news headlines if that happens. It would make the Fed look very politically motivated. Right. And I think that's something they're going to want to avoid and try to avoid, which means that the next potential cut comes November, December. So you're going to have a lot of labor market reports, a lot of inflation reports between now and November. And I think November is my baseline estimate for the potential for a first cut, in large part because of the election. And that just, it's a really tricky situation for the Fed, because there's a lot that could happen in the next 6 months.
Yeah, a great, great points. And Melvin, I think this is getting at exactly what you asked about how likely will rate cuts be if it does happen, how long will it take? And Cullen, the other thing, and I know everybody likes to say that the Fed is really political, but if you go back and look, the Fed, doesn't matter who the chairman is, doesn't matter what party's in Congress, doesn't matter who the president is, traditionally, they like to stay away from making moves either way ahead of the election. It's traditionally something that they really, as you said, doesn't mean they've never done it, but they really try to avoid it. It's almost like a blackout period.
For all the things that I think you can critique about either the Fed or Jerome Powell, I think the one thing that you can definitively say about Jerome Powell is that he has been really steadfast in his sort of anti-political approach to managing the Fed. I mean, we saw this, I don't know if people remember, you know, when Trump was president and the constant berating that Trump was slamming on the Fed back then. And Powell did not succumb to it. So, you know, for all the faults of the Fed and the way that they, you know, they sort of are so data dependent and sometimes rearview mirror looking, I think that Powell has done a really good job of being apolitical as he's managed this Fed.
There's also every once in a while somebody does it. I mean, if you are boring enough to watch C-SPAN and watch every Fed chairman go in front of Congress, they're constantly berated and always under political pressure to toe the line of whatever group they wanted. Another wild card.
It's the worst job in the entire world.
Worst job in the world. Can't make anybody happy. I mean, it's so hard because they've been boxed into a corner by Congress, who keeps spending money. I mean, this is not people say, oh, Treasury spent. No, Congress spends the money, both parties. One thing that we haven't talked about yet, and we're going to sort of run through all these risks as we get closer, is you point out that meeting is the day after the election. It is entirely possible, if it is a tight election, that we don't know who won the day after. So then November gets taken out because there's no way they're going to make a policy move, but we don't even know who's won the presidency. I mean, people don't remember Gore and Bush, but that market does not like that if that happens. And if we're in a tight election where they're counting votes, I mean, that's another nightmare scenario that we may have to.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about that one. I mean, that would almost certainly push the baseline to December. So
yeah, so you're right. It becomes really tricky, which may be why the Fed is sort of, you know, a lot of people were surprised that they weren't more hawkish and that they were keeping the idea of a rate cut alive. But, you know, this is a tricky period that they're going into. So where do you, there is the possibility you think that maybe we still hit a patch where there's a recession. What do you think about the data that's been coming in? So the employment data, Goldilocks today, we've seen some very weak PMI readings in data. We've seen some hot inflation data. Does it seem like stagflationary? Because that's the word everyone's throwing around again. Or do you think some of these are just leading and lagging and we're kind of in that bumpy transition?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people said at the end of last year that the last mile of the inflation fight was going to be the hardest. And that's obviously turned out to be dead right. I mean, the last few years have been, I think, maybe the hardest period to forecast in economic history, just because COVID did so many screwy things to the economy, supply chains, everything, government spending out of control, you know, all this stuff. It made a lot of this so hard to forecast. I think that my baseline view has basically been that the economy is in the process of sort of mean reverting back to all of its pre-COVID scenarios. And I think that those trends are still very much in place. You know, the most interesting data point that I saw this week was actually from the JOLTS report on Wednesday, which is the report from the BLS that comes out before the big labor report every week. And the data point there that was interesting was the quits rate. And the quits rate is indicative of really how tight the labor market is. It shows when people are quitting, what that's indicative of is an environment where people are willing to say, you know what, screw this job, I'm going to get another job, and I don't have any concerns about my ability to get another job or what the wage is going to be. And that's indicative of an environment where basically labor has a lot of negotiating power over capital. And we've seen a really significant decline in the quit rate in the last, really the last, it's been a pretty steady trend over the course of the last sort of 18 months. And that was very persistent in the latest JOLTS report. And then we saw, you know, not to my surprise, the big decline in the hourly earnings from today's labor report. And so all of this, I think, shows that the labor market is continuing to soften, and it's not softening too much yet. But at the same time, there are lots of really strange readings in the underlying data. Like when you look at things like temporary help and things like average hourly earnings. I mean, these are slowing at a rate that is generally indicative of a very slow economy. So, you know, some of the high GDP readings and even the employment reports from the last, you know, 6 to 12 months have been, you know, really surprising, in large part because a lot of the data, like you were saying with PMIs and stuff like that, is still indicative of a very low growth environment. So, you know, and that's pretty consistent with what we had in the pre-COVID environment, where you had really like mostly like 1.5 to 2.5% GDP. And I think that's kind of the baseline that we're going back towards. The big risk being that if the Fed continues to keep things really tight on the monetary policy side, you could potentially find ourselves in a scenario where in November or later this year, things are slowing down a lot more than expected. And the Fed actually is behind the curve in that scenario where, you know, they then probably wish they had cut in July and maybe even, you know, looked political going into the election.
Yeah.
And instead, they're going to find themselves in a situation that's not uncommon for them where they're behind the eight ball again, kind of like they were in 2021 when they didn't raise, when things were starting to look like inflation was starting to get kind of out of control.
We're going to take another quick break to hear a word from our partners. We'll be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
And we talked about this being the hardest job in the world because, of course, it's hard anyway. This is a really tough macro environment coming out of COVID. The signals are mixed. We're going into a very uncertain election, which is sure to be volatile. And add on to that, there's a global element, right, to this inflation picture. That's been coming a lot up a lot in conversations we had this week. We're going to run a clip of some of the sort of highlights of what is on the mind of some analysts, especially when it comes to that global view on inflation.
Sticky inflation can get much worse because of all the balls that we still have being tossed around. Geopolitics, of course, being maybe number one of the balls. But if you haven't noticed, this country has gotten a little bit insane lately, too. And we have an election and we have a lot of spending.
We're at the beginning edge of what will be the last great wave of Chinese product dumping. It's captured everyone's imagination in the electric vehicle space. And that's very, very real. But that's only one small sliver of what's coming. And unlike previous times when some version of this has happened with one country or another, this time the Americans, the Japanese, and the Europeans are not only ready, they're prepared to put into place trade practices that will smash as much of that incoming product as possible. So we're standing today at the beginning of the greatest trade conflict we have seen since the 1920s.
Try to imagine a state of the world 1 year, 2 years, 3 years out on, you know, where are we with the U.S. and China? Is, you know, would China have done a big devaluation? Have they flooded the market? You know, as we're seeing, they've gone from wanting to be the sweatshop of the world to the machine tool shop of the world. If they're moving up the value chain for these products, what's the business model for Korea at that point if there's a big overlap with a giant manufacturer that's exporting deflation? What's the business model for Germany? I think the U.S.-China, it just gets very, very difficult for people to imagine how ugly this could get in the decoupling.
When we look back on this period, let's call it 3 to 5 years from now, in our opinion, we think one dynamic will be very clear, which is the Federal Reserve, rather than go the last mile of disinflation to get inflation sustainably back to 2%, opted to save the economy rather than achieve its inflation mandate. And ultimately, that is structurally bullish for the sustainability of the business cycle, which itself is structurally bullish for risk assets.
And keen observers will know that Scott was not on the Daily Briefing, but that great interview he did with Ash is on the platform. I encourage all of you, if you haven't had a chance to check it out, to go over there. And if you are not a member and can't access it, Brian will drop a link in for you to join so you can do that. So Cullen, against that sort of very uncertain backdrop, what do you like here? Where do you see opportunity?
Well, it's, I mean, again, going back to sort of the time horizon-based perspective that I have, you know, the current environment is sort of interesting because a lot of people are shunning bonds. I actually like bonds probably more today than I have at maybe any point in, God, the last 20 years, especially if you're a short-term saver. I mean, the ability to now get 5.5% on treasury bills, this is the positive side of the higher for longer narrative, is that savers now are getting a real return for the first time in, you know, forever. Right? So, you know, in terms of like, especially shorter time horizons and the potential for the Fed to be cutting, I think that short-term bonds and intermediate bonds look really, really attractive these days. I mean, anything out to like 5 years or so looks super attractive. And I actually would, if I were invested in really short-term treasury bills, I'd probably be thinking these days about extending maturities a little bit, start to front-run the Fed a little bit. If they're going to be cutting in, say, a year or 6 months, it's going to look pretty smart to have front-run them a little bit, locked in higher rates, and get a bit ahead of them. So, you know, the other asset classes are so much trickier in this environment because the stock market now is back to being frothy. The real estate market has been frothy, obviously, for a while here. You know, everything else kind of looks a little more frothy. The commodity markets as a whole look relatively attractive because they've come down in value a lot in the last year or so. So commodities probably look, you know, on the moderately more attractive side. But yeah, I mean, it depends on time horizons. I mean, for super, super long time horizons, I mean, for the investor that has a 20, 30 year time horizon, you know, I always tell people like that, you know, you build a diversified, aggressive portfolio and, you know, lose your password to your brokerage account for 20 years. You'll wake up and probably be pretty happy. So, you know, a lot of this depends on
your time horizon. Right. We always say that. I know it's a sort of loaded question when you started by saying it's all about time horizon. So let's break it down a little bit. We have a question from Timothy, who was super excited to hear you lay it out the way you did, because you're speaking his language. As somebody who is, I think, thinking about his portfolio at this stage of life, he asks, I would appreciate Cullen to go over AI as related to mutual funds in a 401k IRA as the types of funds he looks at. But that's an interesting long-term trade. And it's kind of what I alluded to. We talked about it yesterday. You can believe AI is this transformative exponential trend, but you know, it comes with some risks and some volatility, and you know, we don't know who the winners are going to be. How do you think about that? And totally. Let's say I think Timothy has a shorter horizon, right? He's going to need his money sooner, I'm guessing. You can correct me if you're wrong, Timothy, because based on your smart knowledge in the chat, you probably have enough. But if you're looking at that long trend, but you're closer up on needing that money, how do you think about something like that? Because that's a tricky one.
These are the sorts of trends that I think you have to put into the really long-term bucket of your portfolio. I mean, I think a good way to think about this is, think of the NASDAQ bubble back in 1999. The NASDAQ bubble was not wrong. You know, tech investors back then were not wrong. They were just early. And that's oftentimes all that, you know, euphoria is it's people pricing in things that are not necessarily wrong in the long run, but people just get a little overly, you know, excited about in the short term. And so, you know, the investor who bought even the, you know, the NASDAQ peak, you know, diversified portfolio of tech stocks, that investor still did, you know, wonderfully in the long run, but it took a long time. And I think that thinking of AI in that sort of sense right now is the right way to approach this, where, you know, it's probably almost certainly good to have a component of AI in your portfolio, but you have to go into that thinking, okay, this could go down. It could go down a lot. And in the long run, I'll probably do okay. But in the short term, this has the potential to create a huge amount of volatility in my portfolio. So any sort of transformative technology, any sort of that, this sort of like super high beta stuff, I think you inherently have to think of it as like a super long duration instrument.
Yeah, I think that's That's so good, because the temptation is you see these things, like you see NVIDIA going crazy and you have that FOMO, like if I only had that in my portfolio, I would be doing so much better this year. The other thing is, thank you, Timothy. I was just going to say this. You can have your long-term portfolio with an eye on retirement, and you can have a trading account if you are, you know, of that nature. And maybe that's where you play that AI trend, is in your trading account.
Yep.
Which, by the way, so many people, even the analysts who come on, Colin, right, have that. We don't often talk about that, but they'll say, like, this is what I'm doing. But then I have my, you know, I have my trading account, and then I have my long-term stuff that's different, mm-hmm. you know, even short-term traders.
Yeah, I've got clients who behaviorally, they like to scratch an itch. You know, they like to, you know, sort of, you know, play the markets a little bit, I guess yeah. is the way to put it. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. As long as you've got your plan segmented in a way where you kind of know, like, you know, your trading portfolio doesn't turn into something that could blow up your financial plan. There's nothing wrong with, you know, making, you know, some outside bets and trying to beat the market and stuff like that.
Yeah. So when you were just talking about high beta, and this is another issue I think that's come up that fits into that same kind of category as AI for people, which is cryptocurrency. Now that there's a Bitcoin ETF, I don't know. I'm curious if you're getting inquiries about it, people asking, should I be holding this? Who's it right for? How does it fit in? Is it a hedge? Is it just a risk asset? What are your conversations been around that? And how are you feeling about it?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to AI in the sense that I think of Bitcoin and, you know, crypto broadly, I guess, as sort of this potentially really transformative technology. Especially, I think this is much more, it's interesting that Bitcoin is so popular in the United States, because I think the United States is probably a place where the argument is least persuasive for it. So my view basically is that the, especially third world sort of authoritarian countries, something like Bitcoin and just inflation hedges in general, currency hedges in general, are almost like a necessity to own, because those sorts of governments are so good at destroying their own currencies. The dollar and just the hugely productive output of the U.S. economy, I think, makes that a less persuasive argument relative to the dollar specifically. But in general, I think of something like Bitcoin as it is a real, almost like the ultimate long duration instrument. I mean, I actually try to quantify durations inside of the portfolios I run, and Bitcoin comes out to like a 100-year instrument, basically. So something that is a super long duration instrument that has the potential to, it could transform a lot of monetary systems potentially, or it could just operate as a sort of an inflation hedge. But again, it's something that it regularly goes down 80%, you know, and can go through really significant drawdowns. You can't treat it like a short-term instrument, I think.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And we've been doing a lot of education around that as we go through these cycles, so people can get a handle on, you know, not only whether it's right for them, but how to approach it in a really smart way. The tag on that is don't F this up this time. And Timothy's making me laugh. I think Timothy's a sort of outside character. His risk profile is pretty high. If you're in the chat, you can see what I'm talking about. But for those who do have that itch, who do have a trading account, who do want to play in the markets and have Bitcoin or have the ETF or thinking about it, I just want to give a shout out to Michael, who posted in our New York channel on the RV platform today. He was asking for thoughts about how to play Bitcoin in the near term. You know, buying the dip, do you hodl? You know, what are people's thoughts? If you are an RV member and you're in the New York channel, go check it out. Drop some chat in there for him. And then this is an issue that comes up all the time, and people are really conscious about where to take profits. That's been really hard. Artur and Nico get together every 2 weeks and do a crypto distillery to pull all the alpha coming out of not only the pro tier but the Discord channel, which is on fire. Check out what they had to say about that.
I mean, my thoughts is, like, not only is this price action normal, I think it was expected, you know, for me. And frankly, I think it's a welcome development. I think we were on an unhealthy trajectory. And this past month goes a long way into getting us back on track there. And I have a handful of charts that will, I guess, show all this in the next segment. But for now, yeah, I think the short answer is this is a good thing. I'm not worried at all. I think maybe we even still have a bit further to go. And so just, you know, I'm not panicking. I'm just watching for now.
All right, charts to come shortly. Anyone else have any thoughts, big picture, about what's happening in this market?
Yeah, I mean, I would echo Chris there. I don't think this is out of the norm. I think if you follow liquidity and Michael Howe on the macro side, I think we expected a little bit of a lull in this time and maybe into summer. But also just from a technical perspective, as you'll see on charts when we talk about it, it was fairly extended and you could have guessed that there was going to be some type of a pullback. It's probably deeper than some wanted or expected, but it's still well within the realm of normal.
Some great stuff there. It's such a great community. Again, Brian will drop a link if you want to know where to find that. So Cullen, as we wrap up here and head into the weekend, what's going to be top of mind for you? I suppose I should ask you about the sort of role commodity plays. We talked about the house being one of the biggest commodities, but are you looking at metals or some of the more traditional commodities right now, given the uncertainty out there?
Yeah, I mean, I've been pretty bullish about gold in the last few years, actually, which is sort of a weird position for me, for people who know my history, because I don't typically love precious metals. But I think that I like thinking of especially gold as a very specific form of insurance. Again, I think of gold as a longer duration instrument that is very specifically an inflation hedge. And if, you know, let's say that I think that inflation is going to continue to sort of moderate, consistent with like the trends we saw with like the quit rate and average hourly earnings, the sort of disinflation that we've seen consistently in the last year. But, you know, you diversify because you know you're inevitably going to be wrong at times. And so, you know, gold, if inflation continues to be stickier than expected, gold will continue to perform well. And so, you know, if you, especially kind of going back to our original point about, you know, people who maybe aren't homeowners or don't have a lot of real assets, owning something like gold and, you know, bolstering more of your real assets in your portfolio is just a sensible diversification tool because it operates as an inflation hedge in case you don't own, you know, other sorts of inflation hedges. So,
yeah, great stuff. Cullen, so much good food for thought today. Love the approach and love breaking it down both on that sort of duration and, you know, diversifying through time horizon. It's just so helpful for people as they try to, you know, we all want to protect our money, right? So it's just really great stuff. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was great talking to you.
Great stuff. Have a great weekend. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you next week. Take care and good luck out there.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. At Real Vision, we arm you with the expert knowledge, time-efficient tools, and a powerful network to help you succeed on your financial journey. Get a taste of financial freedom with our free offer at realvision.com/free.